by ancient dominations and helpless destiny, we will not be our burden. We shall be strong and free. There's something about the sight of dirty laundry that seems to have the power to drain me of inspiration, to bring me down to earth with a bump. I don't know how you feel, but I suppose the reality check is by no means a bad thing, because it can also remind me that I have to start thinking on a practical level. Get my hands dirty with the realities of life in front of me. Practice mindfulness and come down out of the ivory tower of my sometimes rarefied mental world. This is possibly my most ambitious talk since beginning my ministry here and at Bury last October. Be prepared, therefore, for this address to be a failure in terms of persuading you of anything at all. Not least because my ideas may go against fashion. My hope, anyway, is that you will nevertheless find one or two nuggets of value hidden like flecks of precious metal within the muck and clod of my deliberations. It is my belief, as a Unitarian pastor, that our conversation as minister and congregation ought not to be one way in any case. On the contrary, our spiritual searching and our questioning is a dialogue, and so it is better for a minister to share honestly that which he is struggling to grasp himself, and even more so to articulate, than for him to present a safe, familiar message designed to please, but which he himself perhaps no longer believes. So with that caveat, I want to begin by telling you about someone I met. These days, the Reverend Olaf Miller is retired and living in Germany. He's also Minister at Large Emeritus of the European Unitarian Universalists, EUU, an association of Unitarian fellowship groups around Western Europe, consisting mainly of expatriate Americans, but increasingly with more and more locals too, if they can figure out what Unitarianism is about. Now, I encountered Olaf around the mid-1990s when EUU surprisingly decided to hold their spring retreat in Canterbury, Kent. And I only remember meeting Olaf, not really exactly what we talked about. What I didn't know back then was that Olaf was present at and the victim of a pivotal and harrowing incident in the history of the civil rights movement in America. You may be aware that the Hollywood film Selma opened in UK cinemas just last Friday. Perhaps we should organise a visit and go and see it. The fact that the film has been released this year is no coincidence. It's the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights March from Selma to the state capital Montgomery, Alabama, in March 1965, organised and led by Martin Luther King Jr. As we heard in our first reading, the headquarters of the Unitarian Universalist Association was one of the bodies to receive a telegram from King on the 7th of March 1965, 50 years ago next month, asking for help and for supporters to come to his aid following the attack by state troopers and sheriff's deputies on non-violent demonstrators on that date. The trailers for the film, Selma, show a studious-looking man in glasses and a bow tie. That man was the Reverend James Reeb, and he answered the call. He came to Selma to take part in the protests for African-American voting rights. Unitarians and clergy and civilians from many other denominations and all walks of life had responded to Martin Luther King's plea to join him and his supporters at Selma, Alabama, to begin a march to the state capital, Montgomery, so that blacks could challenge directly the discrimination that was preventing them from voting. And I've actually heard recently that in one state they are starting to reintroduce some of these discriminatory measures by stealth. So it's an ongoing struggle. After dining together at an integrated restaurant on March the 9th, Reeb and two other Unitarian ministers, Clark Olson and Orloff Miller, were attacked and beaten by white men armed with clubs. The attack occurred less than a day after Reeb had arrived in town. Reeb was beaten most severely of the three men, having been clubbed in the head. Hard for us to believe, though it may be, the fear was that the hospital in Selma would refuse to treat Reeb because he was a protester, and so he was taken to the facility in Birmingham, Alabama, 2 hours' drive away, where doctors carried out brain surgery. And Reeb died 2 days later. His death, produced a national outcry across America against the activities and brutality of white racists in the Deep South. And his death provoked mourning throughout the country. Many vigils were held in Reeb's honor. President Lyndon B. Johnson telephoned Reeb's widow and father to convey his condolences. And on the 15th of March, he invoked Reeb's memory when he delivered a draft of the Voting Rights Act to Congress. However, King chose not to go to Washington, although invited by Johnson. Instead, Martin Luther King Jr. eulogized Reeb at a ceremony at Brown's Chapel in Selma. King said, "James Reeb symbolizes the forces of goodwill in our nation. He demonstrated the conscience of the nation. He was an attorney for the defense of the innocent in the court of world opinion. He was a witness to the truth that men of different races and classes might live, eat, and work together as brothers." In one of my talks here last month, I spoke about James Martineau, the 19th century British Unitarian theologian, and how conscience and not the Bible was central to his thought. In the speech at Reeb's funeral, King invoked that same human virtue, that James Reeb had indeed demonstrated the true conscience of the nation. More than this, that something that had been latent in people of all races in that society was now breaking forth in open protest against injustice. How does this story intersect with our own lives? We can feel admiration for James Reeb and Viola Liuzzo and the neglected Jimmie Lee Jackson and Martin Luther King and the sacrifices they made for justice, but admiration is not enough. We know that the scourge of racism does not affect the United States alone. I can't help but reflect that we are moving into a general election period where the claim is being made in some quarters that immigration is the number one issue, as though somehow our greatest challenges and problems are caused by people coming into this country to live. The implication being that our unjust and unsustainable economic system, the staggering inequality in Britain, the threat of climate change, somehow these are all to be seen as lesser issues. Much easier to blame our difficulties on foreigners, even though such a position could scarcely be more irreconcilable with the teachings of Jesus. And here we should recall chapter 25 of the Gospel of Matthew. "For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in." Our progressive faith tradition calls us to see how we may be called to follow the inspiration of figures like Martin Luther King. We may also recall the words of 19th century Unitarian minister and historian Edward Everett Hale. "I am only one, but I am one. I cannot do everything, but I can do something, and I will not let what I cannot do interfere with what I can do. We ought to ask, therefore, where did Martin Luther King find the inspiration to challenge the forces of oppression? He was a Christian, most certainly, a mainstream Christian at that, and steeped in the gospel. But it will have been seen already that he valued the support of those heretic Unitarians too, and he was also a speaker at the Unitarian Assembly the previous year. He not only valued the support of Unitarians, he was also influenced by Unitarian thinking. With the exception of "I Have a Dream," possibly the most famous quote of Martin Luther King is where he says, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice." And this comes from his 1967 speech, "Where Do We Go From Here?" But the phrase is an adaptation of words by the 19th century Unitarian minister, transcendentalist and passionate abolitionist, Theodore Parker. And it was actually a talk he gave at an abolition meeting. Parker is considered by some to be one of the most significant Unitarian ministers who ever lived, partly for his conscience-based theology and partly for his absolutely uncompromising stance on the abolition of slavery in America. Parker, for a time, kept a loaded gun on his desk while he wrote his sermons, ready to shoot any government officers who might try to apprehend a runaway slave who was sheltering in his home. King and Parker were inspired in the belief that their progressive views were in accord with the direction of history, however long and painful the road. We can say that the idea that history has a direction is present in mainstream Christianity, of course, but it also came very much to the fore in late 18th and 19th century philosophy, especially German philosophy. Parker was an extraordinary linguist and unusual among American Unitarian ministers of his day in being familiar with German philosophy. Another person closely associated with the Unitarian tradition who was familiar with German philosophy and even an important translator was Mary Ann Evans, better known as the novelist George Eliot. In the responsive reading by Eliot today, you may have noticed that she evokes a beauteous order that controls with growing sway the life of humanity, and then later on, the sweet presence of a good diffused, and in diffusion, ever more intense. That's a remarkable idea. She seems to be saying the wider the goodness spreads, the more powerful it can become. I need to think about that some more myself. Anyway, this is not an affirmation of Trinitarian Christianity, for example, but it does reflect a belief in the potential triumph of good. So where am I going with all this? Well, the point I want to make is that while for many religious humanists among Unitarians today, history probably is not seen as having a direction. In which case, what happens is simply a mixture of the forces of nature and the results of our own free actions in a world of indeterminacy and chance. In such a view, meaning is only the meaning we make as individuals, hopefully in a supportive community, within the context of an indifferent universe. I have enormous respect for this view. It has its own logic and coherence. It may work for individuals, I'm sure it does. I have doubts about it as a basis for community. Furthermore, this is not the view of Theodore Parker or Martin Luther King. For these figures, as for German philosophers such as Immanuel Kant, human striving towards the good is vital, but it operates with the grain of history. It accords with the arc of the moral universe, however long that arc may be. Immanuel Kant believed that the possibility of justice was inherent in the nature and direction of things. At the same time, human agency, our human effort, is essential for justice to find its fulfillment. Not only do I think this to be correct, I also consider this to be something tremendously hopeful. It means we are not struggling to do the right thing in the face of insurmountable odds. Our struggles for a better world are not primarily some kind of futile existential howl of protest, against a hostile universe. Neither in my view are we right to place our hope in human reason and make an idolatry of it to the exclusion of all else, as I feel the new atheists often do. Further, in my understanding, that which is idealistic and that which is realistic are not so far apart. So wishing on a star and washing out the laundry are interrelated. Vision is nothing without a reality to which it may be applied. Kant combined the idea of history having the potential for justice with the idea that the human beings have to step up to the mark, as Martin Luther King did, in order that justice should find its fulfillment. I am of the same mind. I believe that the exercise of free will is by no means incompatible with the notion that history has a direction. Where things get really difficult is that if history has an evolutionary thrust, for whose benefit is it? Is it just for a certain race? Is it just for a certain class of people? Some 19th century thinkers and 20th century dictators have thought so. Accusing fingers get pointed at various German philosophers for some of the horrors of the 20th century, and that's understandable up to a point. Do the horrors of the 20th century make my position on the direction of history untenable? Well, I know what I want to say about that. I'm going to have to save my answer for another time. If the Stalinists and fascists are right, then the forces of history will always divide people. The stains of those ideologies are still with us in society today. However, I don't accept that we don't learn from the past. I think we learn very slowly on the collective level, although individuals may have leaps forward in their consciousness and understanding. Still, the persistent stains of hatred and error are like marks on our clothing that we struggle to remove. Even in democratic societies, the traces of failed ideologies keep reappearing, and we have to wipe them away with our commitment to love, to democracy, and to justice. I believe the view of Martin Luther King and Theodore Parker is that opportunities for more love and justice open up to us if we are willing to look and to respond, creating a world of possibility for all. We then have to make the right choice. Let's start making those right choices today. Amen.
Amen.